Today is February the 20th, 2019. Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Do you know who has your personal data? Do you know how Facebook, Google, and Amazon are using your personal data? Is that product you bought from Amazon a counterfeit? You should find out. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming live on the Internet, as well as on various podcast hosting sites. Podcasts of the programs available on prn.fm, on the Internet, and pcradioshow.org. To listen to the live program on the telephone each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, the number is 641-793-7091. For those who are listening to the program on demand, you can leave us a message with your question or comment to Hank at pcradioshow.org. You can also reach us on the Google number 862-800-6805. That's 862-800-6805, and start your message with the Personal Computer Show followed by your message. Have you ever been hit by a fine by a government agency? For instance, if you had a parking ticket, can you imagine if you had the opportunity to negotiate what that fine should be? Of course not. But in the real world of big tech, Facebook is negotiating with the Federal Trade Commission to pay multi-billion dollar fine tied to the Cambridge Analytica scandal, as reported by the Washington Post. The fine is related to Cambridge Analytica improperly accessing the data of 87 million Facebook users. And of course, Facebook says they never sold them the data. What they said was, since they happened to be an advertiser, they had the privilege of being able to look at the information. Wouldn't you call that selling the information? Well, I guess in terms of semantics, they may be right. They didn't sell the information. This fine, if agreed upon, would be the largest ever imposed by the Federal Trade Commission against a tech company. The two sides are still negotiating the details. The Washington Post reported that a settlement penalty in the billions of dollars would be by far the largest fine ever imposed by the FTC against a technology company. The agency's biggest fine against a tech company to date came in 2012, when Google agreed to pay a $22.5 million penalty due to its privacy practices. The FTC began probing Facebook in March of last year, following reports that political consulting firm Cambridge Analytica had improperly accessed the data of 87 million Facebook users. What do you mean they improperly accessed it? They accessed it because Facebook made it available. Facebook did not respond to a request for comment to the Washington Post. Amazon cancels plans for New York City. Last week on St. Valentine's Day, Amazon pulled out of a plan to build an East Coast headquarters in New York City after facing fierce community opposition to what promised to be a massive corporate campus. Amazon issued the following statement. After much thought and deliberation, we decided not to move forward with our plans to build a headquarters for Amazon in Long Island City, Queens, while polls show that 70% of New Yorkers support our plans and investment. A number of state and local politicians have made it clear that they oppose our presence and will not work with us to build the type of relationship that are required to go forward with the project. We and many others envision in Long Island City. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo blamed the reversal on a small group of politicians who put their own narrow political interest above their community. Cuomo and New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio have drawn fire from local officials and community activists for arranging the deal behind closed doors. The about-face for Amazon comes just 3 months after it announced the locations for its new facilities and following a roughly year-long contest in which more than 200 cities around the United States pitched the company on why they should be home to the headquarters. Amazon announced the results in November, saying it would split the site between New York and Northern Virginia, bringing about 25,000 high-paying jobs to each location in exchange for generous tax incentives. But those tax breaks became a major sticking point for the project's opponents. By some estimates, the headquarters could have cost New York City and the state over $3 billion, roughly equal to the amount the company said it planned to invest. A Quinnipiac University poll in December found that New York City residents supported having an Amazon headquarters by a margin of 57% to 26%. But opinions were mixed over the hefty tax breaks, with 46% in favor and 44% against. The reaction to the cancellation has been mixed. New York political officials who backed Amazon's headquarters decried the news, saying it would cost the city jobs and revenue. Some financial experts also said Amazon's move is a blow to New York's tech sector. While noting that the city is doing just fine, Amazon's decision to withdraw its New York City headquarters is a setback for the city that illustrates politics and anti-business sentiment can derail economic development despite competitive strengths. Moody's Investors Service said in a statement, "High-tech employment will grow more slowly without Amazon's expected 25,000 new jobs, but the city's economic fundamentals remain positioned to grow strongly in the future." Amazon's capitulation shows the strength of labor advocates in one of the last cities in the United States where unions are well represented. While some workers, especially the construction trades, supported the project, many others criticized what they said was a long history of mistreating workers and squashing their efforts to organize. Amazon said it does not plan to reopen the search, but rather will continue to hire at its existing facilities and in Virginia, where its new development has been welcome. The following is an editorial comment on my part, not necessarily shared by my colleagues or anyone else affiliated with the station. Let me ask the question, where was the love lost on St. Valentine's Day? The announcement by Amazon on the selection of headquarters in New York was 3 months ago. Why might Amazon have been attracted to New York in the first place? Big tech companies like Google, Facebook, and Twitter are attracted to cities like New York, Los Angeles, Seattle, and Washington because these cities had already made transformative public investment in assets like culture, parks, universities, and transit. Google and Facebook already have headquarters here in New York and has established, not incidentally, without any state subsidies. Google intends to double its workforce in the city to nearly 20,000. Twitter's second largest office is in Manhattan. Last fall, the campus of Cornell Tech, modeled after Stanford University as an innovation incubator, opened on Roosevelt Island. Here in New York, tech is one sector in a megalopolis sharing the limelight with finance, media, fashion, and advertising and art. American cities and states now spend some $90 billion a year in cash and tax incentives to attract companies, money that could go for infrastructure, schools, and police. New York City's abundance of resources, talent, and ideas derive from its exceptional diversity and social infrastructure and urban virtues. Amazon could profit from its enhancement of New York as much as New York could profit from Amazon's presence. What does it mean? For starters, it means that the city and state could have even more reason to funnel money into subways, buses, and a new tunnel under the Hudson River, and to come up with funding for the stalled BQ&E streetcar project linking Brooklyn and Queens, all of which would have served Amazon. The question for city residents is what these companies give back. A sticking point was the $3 billion in subsidies. Was the $3 billion up front to create the support infrastructure needed in Astoria, Queens? Or was it for tax breaks at defined points of milestones? Neither the governor nor Amazon gave any projections over any period of time how much Amazon may contribute to the economy in tax revenue. What are the infrastructure costs to be added, such as transportation, schools, parking, and housing needed in Astoria to support the staffing? Neither the governor nor Amazon have publicly addressed these issues as it affects the community of Astoria. For years, big tech has promoted sprawl and traffic jams and transform communities into phenomenally expensive places to live. Amazon promised tens of thousands of new jobs in New York, with all sorts of ripple effects beyond employing coders, sales executives, barristers, nannies, and yoga instructors, and other jobs. And in one fell swoop, it bids to make good on 20 years of whole post-Manhattan coup out-of-borough narrative. The collapse of the deal may have been the inevitable result of the notoriously anti-union stance of Amazon. The $3 billion subsidy is seen by the unions to extract lucrative incentives from taxpayers in the most unionized large city in the state. Governor Cuomo blamed the reversal on a small group of politicians. It was, however, the governor and mayor who sidestepped the usual public process for approving such projects and arranged the deal behind closed doors. To date, no details have been released. So where was the love on St. Valentine's Day? Everyone shares the blame. Poor negotiations by inept politicians, community leaders who are ignorant on short and long-term economics, and small business owners and residents who are afraid of gentrification, along with those who are too involved in the details of a problem to look at the situation as a whole to find a mutual benefit. The fact Amazon said it was now not looking for a replacement site for New York gives us a little wiggle room for hope that a more open, transparent governor and mayor may regain the trust of the public and be able to revive Amazon's interest in New York. What say you, the listening public? NASA rover finally bites the dust on Mars after 15 years. NASA's Opportunity, the Mars rover that was built to operate for just 3 months, but kept going and going and rolling across the rocky red soil, was finally pronounced dead last Wednesday, 15 years after it landed on the planet. The six-wheeled vehicle that helped gather the critical evidence that ancient Mars might have been hospitable to life was, well, it was up and running for until 8 months ago when it was finally doomed by a ferocious dust storm. Flight controllers tried numerous times to make contact, and they sent one final series of recovery commands last Tuesday night, along with one last wake-up song by Billie Holiday, I'll Be Seeing You. There was no response from space. They only had silence. The news amounted to a funeral at the space agency Jet Propel Labs in Pasadena, California, of their beloved Opportunity. They said that this is a hard day, even though it's a machine and we're saying goodbye, it's still very hard and very poignant, but we had to do that. We came to that point. The two slow-moving golf cart-sized rovers landed on opposite sides of a planet in 2004 for a mission meant to last 90 Mars days, which are 30 minutes longer than Earth days. In the end, Opportunity outlived its twin by 8 years and set endurance and distance records that will probably stand for decades. Trundling along until communication ceased last June, Opportunity roamed a record 28 miles and worked longer than any other lander in the history of space exploration. Opportunity was a robotic geologist equipped with cameras and instruments at the end of a mechanical arm for analyzing rocks and soil. Its greatest achievement was discovering, along with Spirit, evidence that ancient Mars had water flowing on its surface and might have been capable of sustaining life. These rover missions were meant to help answer the question, does life form wherever conditions are just right, or are we really just really, really lucky? The twin vehicles also pioneer a way of exploring the surface of other planets. The rover gave us the ability to actually row right up to the rocks that we want to see, row up to them, be able to look at them close with a microscopic imager, bang on them with a little bit, shake them up a little, and scratch them a little bit, and to take measurements. Understand what the chemistry is of these rocks, and then say, oh, that was interesting, now I want to go over there. Opportunity was exploring Perseverance Valley when the fiercest dust storm in decades hit and contact was lost. The storm was so intense that it darkened the sky for months, preventing sunlight from reaching the rover's solar panels. When the sky finally cleared, Opportunity remained silent, its internal clock possibly so scrambled that it no longer went to sleep or wake up to receive commands. Flight controllers sent more than 1,000 recovery commands, all in vain. With project costs reaching $500,000 a month, NASA decided to pull the plug and discontinue its operation. Scientists consider this the end of an era, now that Opportunity and Spirit are both gone. Opportunity was the fifth of 8 spacecrafts to successfully land on Mars, all belonging to NASA. Only 2 are still working. The nuclear-powered Curiosity rover, prowling around since 2012, and the recently arrived InSight, which just this week placed a heat-sensing, self-hammering probe on the dusty red surface to burrow into the planet like a mole. 3 more landers from the United States, China, and Europe are due to launch next year. The overriding goal is to search for evidence of past or even present life on Mars, and find suitable locations to send astronauts sometime in the future. While it is sad that we move from one mission to the next, it's all really part of one big objective. Spectrum is offering 30 megabits per second internet service for just $14.99 if you qualify. Part of the deal for Charter Communications to buy Time Warner Cable was that they would offer low-income internet plans. This was one of the reasons the FCC agreed to approve of the merger. So, if you are on a supplemental security income or community eligibility provision or the National School Lunch Program, you can get 30 megabits per second internet for just $14.99 a month. The best part of this is the fact that there are no data caps on these plans, making them a great option for cord cutters who qualify. The modem that comes with it does not include Wi-Fi, but you can add Wi-Fi for $5 a month, or you can buy your own Wi-Fi router, which I recommend, and plug it into your modem. To get the deal, your family needs to participate in the National School Lunch Program or be a senior who is 65 and older, receiving Supplemental Security Income Program benefits. Any family of 4 with an income of $44,995 or less will qualify for the National School Lunch Program in New Jersey. Check your local requirements because they vary depending on what poverty level is in each state. You can learn more about this deal on the Spectrum website. I did go to the Spectrum website, and part of it, which I read to you, is that the available internet speed may vary by address. Download speeds are up to 30 megabits per second, and upload speeds are up to 4 megabits per second. Wi-Fi equipment, activation, and installation fees may apply. You qualify? Check into it. Since I'm talking about the internet, there's another news item that is of interest to the consumer. Your cable company may soon be forced to be more transparent about the bill they send you. 2 Democratic lawmakers introduced a bill this month that would require phone, cable, and internet providers to include all charges in advertised prices. Customers are really bewildered by too-good-to-be-true cable and internet deals could soon get a break. Legislation introduced this month by U.S. Representative Anna Eshoo, a Democrat from California, and Senator Ed Markey, a Democrat from Massachusetts, would require phone, cable, and internet providers to include all charges in advertised prices. Often, we get a bill from these companies, and the advertised price could be far from the actual price you have to pay with all the hidden charges. And many of the charges, we don't even know what they mean. The Truth in Billing Remedies and User Empowerment Over Fees Act of 2019, or the True Fees Act of 2019, would allow consumers to terminate contracts early without paying a penalty if a provider increased a fee or charged a price that isn't clearly illustrated in the original listing. Often we get added charges after we come to agreement on charges, and then there are new charges. Under the proposed legislation, companies would have to alert a consumer of any increase no later than 21 days before it goes into effect, giving the consumer ample time to cancel the service and or switch to another cable provider. Public Knowledge, an open internet and public interest nonprofit in Washington, D.C., endorsed the bill, arguing that such advertisements are deceptive and prevent consumers from accurately comparing costs of different products. The legislation would require phone, cable, and internet providers to include all charges in advertised prices. Often, we don't comment on bills that come before Congress until they are enacted, but this one is of consumer interest and benefit, and I wholly endorse that this bill can become legislation and that anyone who agrees with it should write to their congressmen or women and tell them you support it. Often, a customer will get a bill that is $50 or more higher than expected due to hidden charges. These fees can include taxes and equipment rental fees, which are charged when an internet company requires a customer to use a router or other device for its services. An organization, Public Knowledge, said all these extra fees add up and said they're misleading. Companies are discovering new excuses all the time to break out costs of doing business into new secret fees so they can advertise fictional prices. The Internet and Television Association, a trade group for U.S. broadband and pay television industry, said cable service providers are transparent about pricing and deliver itemized bills to customers through monthly statements and their websites. Cable companies are often open to negotiation on prices rather than see a customer move to a rival service. They may even lower prices if the customer phones in to express concerns about their statement. Often, consumers are deterred by long hold times and poor customer service, so the true bill would require companies to give consumers the option to make changes online. Services like BillShark and Trim also analyze monthly bills and can help negotiate lower prices. From the mailbag, listener XR sent us the following. He wrote, "I have a unique problem and am trying to find a solution. My identity has been compromised. In the past 4 years, my Fios was hacked. The phone, internet, and TV. The passwords to my email accounts have been hacked. It was quite a feat how that was accomplished since I use complex passwords and don't give my passwords to anyone. I've had 2 laptop computers stolen. I believe that my landlord has made it possible for my neighbors to pretend that one of them is my roommate and have given him access to my apartment. Food, clothing, textiles, banking information, birth certificates, and other important personal documents have been stolen from my apartment. My mobile phone has been hacked, wherein text messages were deleted and then access passwords were changed. Now that you have the gravity of my situation, here are my questions. If you can help me, I would greatly appreciate your help. Is there a way to turn off someone's remote access to my technology? I have ZTE Maven, which I disconnected from AT&T, which would turn on by itself. The only way for me to stop it was to remove the battery. My Lenovo T520 would update or perform functions like turning on Skype when I left it in sleep mode. It would also turn itself off after a period of time in sleep mode. Is there a way to remove key logging software which doesn't seem to come up in a malware byte scan? I believe that there has to be a key logger that captures my passwords on both my mobile phones and my computer. That's the only thing of which I can think could be happening because I still seem to get hacked even after I change to a new complex password. Is there a way to block my computer from receiving unauthorized Wi-Fi signals? I believe that my computer is being accessed when I am not using it, even though it is hidden in my locked apartment. Please help me if you can." You have a multitude of problems. The fact laptops were stolen from the physical premise means your living quarters are not secured. Instead of surmising the landlord may have given entry to someone who posed as a relative, ask the landlord if this is the case. Change the locks. If the landlord must have the key, install a security camera. The Nest Cam indoor camera is a popular unit to use. It can commute remotely and send alerts to your smartphone. Hiding your computer is not the same as locking it up. If physical possessions continue to be stolen, I would find some way else to live. Change all your passwords and keep any copy of the passwords in a sealed envelope. If anyone has access to it, the seal would be broken. Mark the envelope with something that is of non-significant description. In the enterprise or business environment, passwords are changed every 30, 60, or 90 days. In your case, instead of trying to find out piecemeal what may have been installed onto the system that is unwanted, I would just save the data and reinstall the entire operating system. I assume, of course, you have been doing faithful backups. Whatever you find that may be vulnerable and at fault will not give you the confidence you have found and eliminate all the problems. From your description, it seems you may be operating almost everything in a wireless mode. Our advice is simple. If at all possible, do not do any online transactions such as banking, paying bills, internet purchases, which confidential data is needed. A major vulnerability in the use of wireless communications is you don't know who may be on your operating network. I had a technical segment on the January 30th broadcast, which I covered the program Wireless Network Watcher. Wireless Network Watcher is a small utility that scans your wireless network and displays a list of all computers and devices that are currently connected to your network. You may not realize it, but there are wireless devices on your network that you're not aware of, such as home assistants, smart televisions, cordless telephones, wireless printers, and many other devices under the category of the Internet of Things. The default access to these devices can be used as backdoor to your system. The default values are not normally changed by most users. Do not do any online transactions on wireless. Connect directly to the Ethernet RJ45 connector. That means use hardwired connections. Dave S. wrote the following. I wanted you to ask Marty Winston why he chose structural insulated panels, SIP, over insulated concrete panel, ICF, because from my research, ICF is more durable, and since he's building in a mild climate, he doesn't need extreme energy efficiency in the building envelope. Marty?
Dave Scrimenti wrote, Hi Hank, I wanted you to ask Marty Winston why he chose SIP rather than ICF. From my research, ICF is more durable. And since he's building in a mild climate, he doesn't need extreme energy efficiency in the building envelope. Well, Dave, thanks for asking. The design calls for both. ICF, insulated concrete forms, get made when concrete is poured into a form that has insulating foam on both sides. The result is thick and durable with good insulating qualities. Well, I know that there are many structures built with ICFs forming their complete outer walls. That really wasn't a look I wanted to achieve for the house above ground. So, my design calls for using ICFs to form the foundation, in this case, the crawl space. For the above ground walls, SIP walls, S-I-P, stands for structural insulated panels. Well, SIP walls provide more flexibility. SIP walls are a bonded, meaning glued together sandwich, of engineered flat boards called oriented strand board, or OSB. It's like, plywood on steroids. Well, the OSB is on either side of thick, aggressively insulating foam. There are no thermal pathways. Those are called bridges. No thermal bridges between the outer board and the inner board. And it's much easier, meaning faster, meaning less expensive, to cut it for placing windows and doors. Thanks for asking.
Benjamin, we just had a listener talk about how his password got hacked, and perhaps you can give us a primer on what is the next level that will give us stronger authentication besides just the use of the password itself.
Technology in the workplace is abundant. I'm Benjamin Rockwell, and now is the time for us to put on that work hat and talk about those things you might hear about at the office, but you're not quite sure about the deeper aspects. Today, I'm addressing the world of, yes, the IT professional and two-factor or multi-factor authentication. Now, we have been dealing with passwords for a long time in the workplace. You go to your system, you just sit down, you turn on your computer if it's not already on, and it presents you with, yes, your username, and then you just type in your password. Sometimes, some systems are set up these days so you're not even presented with a username. That's an actual additional level of security to make sure that somebody isn't piggybacking off of already known information, meaning this. You sit down at your computer, or the bad guy sits down at the computer, and the default name comes up. So in your case, it's easier. In the case of the bad guy, it's also easier. Yeah, that's right. So we're slowing them down by having them guess your username and also guess your password. Maybe it's not so easy, or maybe it's not so hard to guess your username or your password, but it's something that we're slowly working to break down. We're slowing the bad guys down. Now, a way we can slow them down further is by applying two-factor or multi-factor authentication. This is where we take something you know, that's your password, and then we add in something you have, that's your second factor authentication, or something you are. That could be your multi-factor, or it's optional in either location, or actually across all three of those. So it can be something you have and something you are, and those are your two factors, or something you know and something you have, or all of these different things all mixed together. You can mix and match. So something you know, that's your password. Something you have, so you have your iPhone, your smartphone, and on your smartphone, there's this application there, and you press a button, and a number pops up. That would be that something you have. So passwords and that little PIN code that pops up on your smartphone. Or sometimes it'll pop up on this little token, a key fob that sits in your pocket. So there's your something you know and then something you have. Now, what is that something you are? That would be your fingerprint authentication or a handprint, some kind of biometrics. So they're measuring, the distance between the loops, the whorls, and all of those different things that are on your fingerprint, or the size of your hand. Yes, that's one particular thing. Or your eyeball. So there's a number of these different things that all work together. The more we mix in, the safer that information is going to be. For instance, if it's something you know, so they've got to know your password. If you, heaven forbid, pass away, nobody's going to know your password, so they can't break in. Well, okay, maybe they might know that. But what about that something you have? That key fob, that smartphone app, all of that put together. Well, that's still slowing them down. Or if we put all three of those together, your password, that little two-factor authentication software that's on your smartphone, and, oh yes, your fingerprint. We have this balance, though. We have to address these things very carefully. Sure, it's easy for us to say, yes, we're going to, us as IT people, we're going to enact this across the board. So everybody's going to have to put in their thumbprint, and then we're going to scan something that they have. They're going to scan their RFID chip that's inside their body. Ooh, that's kind of creepy. And oh yeah, then they're going to still have to enter in the password. That starts to slow everybody down. And I don't like that. So we add in reasonable measures for that multi-factor authentication. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. Microsoft's new Chrome extension lets you resume browsing across Windows 10 devices. Windows 10 Timeline feature was launched by Microsoft last year. It replaced the familiar Task View button that shows what apps are currently running on the system. Timeline lets you see what apps are running, but also what apps and activities you've used on your Windows 10 PC in the past 30 days. These activities and apps sync across multiple machines. So if you've been using a laptop for a document, you can easily pick up the same activity on a desktop PC that you've also signed into. You can also combine Timeline with Microsoft Edge for iOS and Android and access the smartphone browser history on your PC. Microsoft is updating its mobile Edge apps to support this, and it's one of the main reasons you might use Timeline. If you're concerned about the privacy aspects of having documents, apps, and activity history in your task view, Microsoft disables this device sync by default, and you can disable activity history. Unfortunately, Windows 10 Timeline was limited to Microsoft Edge browser on the browsing history side. But now Microsoft has released its own official Chrome extension for Windows Timeline, dubbed Web Activities. The extension will sync and show your Chrome browsing history across Windows 10 devices so you can use the built-in Timeline viewer. The only caveat is that in order to resume tasks across devices, Windows 10 has to track your PC activities, which for many users isn't a big deal, but for others, it can be a privacy or security concern. If Timeline isn't for you, or you simply don't want Windows 10 collecting your activities, it's possible to disable the feature with just a few clicks using the setting app. That does mean when Timeline is on, a copy of your browsing history will be sent to Microsoft servers, opening up potential privacy concerns. Google does have its own way to sync browsing history between Chrome sessions, including the ability to view tabs on other devices. Microsoft's Chrome extension simplifies this by building it directly into the Task View feature of Windows 10 that's accessible from the taskbar or by using a Win key plus tab. Microsoft has not yet launched a Firefox version of this particular Timeline extension. Although unofficial, Chrome and Firefox Timeline extensions have been available for more than 6 months now. You can download Microsoft's new Chrome Timeline extension from the Chrome Web Store. Microsoft Windows updates will require browsers to support SHA-2. Hey, that was a mouthful. What the heck is SHA-2? It stands for Secure Hash Algorithm 2. It is a set of cryptographic hash functions designed by the United States National Security Agency, NSA. The following browsers have SHA-2 as part of their support, and you would need it for the future Windows updates. Chrome 26 and up, Firefox version 1.5 and up, Internet Explorer version 6 and up with XP where you must have SP3 already installed. Conqueror version 3.5.6 and up. Mozilla version 1.4 and up. Netscape version 7.1 and up. And Windows 7 users, you'll need SHA-2 support or you'll have no Windows updates after July 2019. Microsoft will begin rolling out SHA-2 standalone updates for Windows 7 and Windows Server 2008 in March in preparation for its July 16th implementation deadline. Windows 7 and Windows 7 Server 2008 users need to have SHA-2 code signing installed by July 16th in order to continue to get Windows updates after that date. Microsoft issued that warning last week via a support article. Windows operating system updates are dual sign using both SHA-1 and SHA-2 hash algorithms to prove authenticity. Microsoft officials have said previously that Windows updates will be using the more secure SHA-2 algorithm exclusively. Customers running Windows 7 SP1, Windows Server 2008 Release 2 SP1, and Windows Server 2008 SP2 must have SHA-2 code signing support installed by July 2019. On March the 12th, Microsoft is planning a standalone update with SHA-2 codesign support for Windows 7 SP1 and Windows Server 2008 R2 SP1. Microsoft will make available a standalone update with SHA-2 codesign support for Windows Server 2008 SP2 on April the 9th, 2019. On June 18th, Windows 10 updates 1709, 1803, 1809, and Server 2019 will have their signatures changed from dual sign SHA-1, SHA-2 to only SHA-2 with no customer action required. SHA, which is SHA, has been used in SSL certificates, encrypted communications, and code revision control systems. SHA-2 uses SHA-1 algorithm, but it uses different input and output sizes for superior security. Microsoft began blocking sites signed with SHA-1 certificates in its Edge and IE browsers back in 2017. Last night was a full moon and a supermoon, bigger and brighter than many months, which got Marty Winston thinking about seeing in the dark. Marty, enlighten us and try not to trip over yourself.
Okay, let's talk about things that go bump in the night. And I'm less concerned with ghoulies and ghosties and long-leggedy beasties than I am with my head and my ankles and my shins taking those bumps because there's some barrier I misjudged in the dark. I have blue eyes, so they're more sensitive to glare than the norm. Once they're dark acclimated, any half moon or brighter is pretty good for me seeing my way around. It's not all that good for details, but it's pretty good for, bigger items like posts and rails and the hose that got left out. It wouldn't take much to add an outdoor light with a motion sensor and a photo sensor. You've seen them. It turns on only when it sees motion and only when it's dark out. That's off the shelf from a lot of stores, and it's fine as long as there's power, as long as the bulb still works, as long as the glare doesn't upset the neighbors or wake my wife. Okay, it's one answer, but let's keep thinking. I always carry a small pocket LED flashlight. That's fine if the battery is good and I have a hand free to carry it. I also own several headband lights. They're handy for rolling the trash cans down the driveway one night a week, but I usually don't remember to put one on when what I'm doing is some backdoor chore. So floodlights and flashlights and headlights, all useful. I've tried those little solar-powered path lights that soak up the sun in the daytime and light after dark. If you ever find one of those that doesn't start dim and get dimmer and doesn't run out of juice in, just an hour or two, please drop a line and tell me about it. Give me the name. Tell me where you bought it. For the moment, I'm going to treat those as not useful. Know why? If you own a dog, you'll understand. It's more than a couple hours after dark when the dog drags you into the yard yet again for yet another visit before or after bedtime. One thing that all of these lights have in common is that they all use electricity as their fuel. We should consider other fuels and add to our light the night options, right? Candles, oil lamps, gas lanterns, torches, those little luminescent sticks where you bend them to break a capsule inside, shake them up, and they glow for a while. So far, though, one way or another, the useful solutions are all pay-as-you-go. They're either disposable, one-use things like those shake-em-up sticks, or they use fuel, or they spin the electric meter, or they go through batteries. Now, let me bundle all of this light-in-the-night thinking and put it into the kind of thinking behind our projects for making a house more energy-miserly. In those projects, we're willing to spend a little more upfront in order to cut what we have to spend month after month after month in the long term. And also, we want to dodge some bigger bills like repairs or replacements or hospital time that could come up later. And it all has to mean saving enough in 2 to 3 years or less that we more than cover the cost of doing the project. So, if we don't want our bones to go bump in the night and don't want to pay for lights or electricity or oil or gas or batteries, what's left? Lightning bugs? Well, almost. I have a six-syllable word to share and explain that holds the key to an interesting solution. The word is photoluminescent. That means it glows for a while after first being exposed to light. You may have had some small molded plastic toys that would glow in the dark. Same thing, photoluminescent toys, photoluminescence is the phenomenon. That glow comes from phosphors. And for the past 10 years, more actually, research into improved phosphors has been accelerating madly because of their role in being what really glows in an LED light bulb. The actual LED emitter in the bulb is blue, not quite ultraviolet. The blue emitter energizes the phosphor, and the phosphor emits the white light we see. Last month, I got my hand on a new photoluminescent paint called Cereus. That's spelled C-E-R-E-U-S. It's from Bamboo Global, and that's spelled B-A-M-B-U. 15 minutes in decent light lets these paints glow for as long as 10 hours into the night. 10 hours, man, that means that if it's the middle of December and the sun sets at 5, the glowing doesn't stop going until 3 in the morning. Believe me, it's not that often that I'm out in the yard even that late in the middle of December. I did some testing. They're red paint, meaning it looks red with the lights on, glows red-orange. The yellow glows, well, yellow with a slightly greenish hue. The green paint, which looks a little olive under daylight, glows true green at night. The blue, very natural, glows in a true blue. The white paint is interesting because, well, the paint itself is white. Its glow is a very light blue, and that glow is also working when the lights are on. So the perception is that it's a little off-white with a slight blue-green hue. The blue and the white provide the brightest nighttime glow, but they're all these colors are highly visible in the dark. And that got me to thinking. I can trim the deck rails and the edges of steps and any posts or gates in a color that suits them. Easily pick them out in the dark, never create so much glow that it disturbs neighbors, and not have to spend a penny for years and years and years until the paint needs touching up. There are also, you should know, some photoluminescent tape products. I haven't tested those yet. You can search Amazon, for example, and find some photoluminescent tapes that are inexpensive enough to just play with. I have no idea how waterproof they are. But the issue of weather is important beyond just whether a tape product can survive it. Think about it. To avoid accidents, you're painting or taping surfaces. If those surfaces get covered with snow, well, you don't see the glow. Photoluminescence isn't warm. It won't melt the snow. So you might want to concentrate on vertical surfaces that are less likely to hold the snow. Oh, also the same for the undersides of rails. Also, in a different interpretation of things that go bump in the night, but this time using no power and not using photoluminescence. If you have a curbside mailbox, I'm a big believer in putting reflectors on its post to help make the mailbox less invisible to inattentive drivers. Backyard dog walking isn't the only activity that people tend to pursue after dark, and next time I'll be talking about revelry. After all, it's the show just before Mardi Gras. And even without the parades and parties and beads, we all like to enjoy some occasional revelry in our homes. So I'll share some ideas about how your home can help with that.
Thank you, Marty. Public service announcements. Computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. The computer clubs have random access sessions at each of these club meetings. If you have any questions or need for technical advice, the club members are more than happy to assist. There is no such thing as a dumb question. Princeton PC Users Group will have a presentation on Cut the Cord, Things to Consider Before Firing Your Cable Company. Meeting is Thursday, February 26th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. and they meet at the Mercer County Library, Lawrenceville, New Jersey. The Brookdale Computer User Group has a presentation on how to avoid internet and telephone computer scams. Thursday, February 28th, meeting time is 6:45 p.m. in the Middletown Library Lodge Meeting Room at 55 New Monmouth Row, Middletown, New Jersey. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey has their general meeting on Friday, March the 1st. Meeting time is 8 p.m., and they meet at the Scotch Plains Rescue Squad, located at 1916 Bartow Avenue, Scotch Plains, New Jersey. Danbury Area Computer Society has their meeting on Tuesday, March the 5th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and they have a new meeting place now, Danbury Hackerspace at 158 Main Street in Danbury, Connecticut. The Westchester PC Users Group has a meeting on Thursday, March the 7th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and they meet at the Keller Williams Realty, 120 Bloomingdale Road in White Plains, New York. The Long Island Macintosh Users Group meets Friday, March the 8th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and they meet at the Harry J. Scherr Hall at the New York Institute of Technology, Old Westbury Campus out in Old Westbury, New York. The Kingsbyte Computer Club has their meeting on Tuesday, March the 12th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and they meet at the Park Plaza Restaurant located at 220 Cadman Plaza West in Brooklyn, New York. All these club meetings are free and open to the public. If you have a computer club meeting you want me to announce on the air, send me a note. My address is hank@pcradioshow.org. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm on the Internet. If you have any questions for us or commentary on any of our feature segments, just send us your email address with your telephone number, in which we can call you at a convenient hour for playback on the program. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. There's no such thing as a stupid question. In the meantime, stay in touch and keep on computing and remember to back up. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station next week.